Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing okay, Justin. How are you?
I am great.
Actually, you know what? I'm doing great now. I'm feeling really good now.
Yay.
You know why?
Why is that?
Because we're recording again. That means people like us enough that they keep listening and the show keeps growing, and then we just keep putting out more episodes, so we keep getting together every week.
Yeah. What announcements do we have?
I know recently we've had some issues with apps where we release our content. Well, Spotify has been ironed out. So if you really like Spotify, then start using it.
How about Google Play? Is it still ironing that?
Yeah, Google Play is tricky. So, but Spotify is all worked out. So I would suggest using Spotify if you're looking for something to listen to our podcast on.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
On tonight's case, I had the pleasure of interviewing the directors of Evil Genius, the new miniseries on Netflix, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's a 4-episode series. And if you don't know about it, then what are you waiting for? You should be watching it.
In fact, you should probably watch it before you listen to this episode because there's going to be major spoilers and discussions about things that happened on that show. Aaron and I are going to do our best to set it up for you before we get into the interview with the directors, but it's better that you just watch the show.
This is seriously something that we wanted to watch and talk about. It's just like you at home. If you're a fan of true crime, if you get fascinated with these different stories and wonder how this is reality, you can't miss this. So that's how this episode came about.
August 28th, 2003, there's a phone call placed to a Italian restaurant pizza place called Mamma Mia's. They're wanting a delivery, and owner of the pizza parlor is not quite understanding the order or the address. And Brian Wells takes the phone and writes down the address, and he is the delivery driver. Brian is 46 years old. He is sort of a, I won't say a loner, but not a really outgoing guy. He lives in what appears to be a guest house in a backyard with his cats. And he has a couple friends, but just isn't the most sociable guy. He also likes scavenger hunts and is active with the local newspapers whenever they do a citywide scavenger hunt or whatever it may be, some sort of fun little task that people can win, and he would engage in those. So he gets the address for this pizza delivery, which is to an abandoned antenna array, which this is a little odd.
It's in Erie, Pennsylvania, and that's at the northernmost part of Pennsylvania.
He takes off to deliver this pizza, and next thing we know is he shows up at a PNC bank with a device around his neck that is a bomb and a cane gun. So it's a walking cane, but it has a shotgun shell in it. And he shows up at this bank, and he's waiting in line sort of calmly at first. But once the line moves on, he actually cuts ahead and says, "Hey," and he hands the teller a note and pretty much informs them that this is a bank robbery.
Well, and let's be clear, no one really knows it's a bomb because it's underneath his shirt. And the shirt actually says "guess" on it. But his shirt is bulging out quite a bit underneath his chin.
Yeah, and I think it's actually even another shirt on top. Like, he has his regular shirt on, then the collar bomb, and then there's another t-shirt that has the written words, like I think it says "guess what this is," and that's over the collar bomb. So really weird.
Do you think that whoever wrote on this shirt, do you think that they were sort of doing a play on words with the company "guess"?
Possibly, because "guess" was actually a popular brand back then, but maybe they were just being straightforward. "Guess what this is? It's a bomb. Ha ha." I don't know. It's very possible. While he's waiting on the money, he reaches over to the candy dish and grabs a lollipop, sort of casual and not exactly in a rush. The note that he handed the teller was a long rambling note.
I would almost say a letter.
Yeah, it was a whole page. He had another letter that he gave to the bank manager that had a lot of threats and "you better go to the vault and get us all this stuff." So he has two separate notes here. Now, normally when you rob a bank, it's "I have a gun," or "I have a bomb," or "I have some sort of weapon. Give me all the money." It's real simple. You could write it down on a napkin. these are long-winded instructions for the teller and the bank manager.
Which, okay, so this seems like such a bad idea because when you write something that long, what if these are slow readers? I mean, how much time are you planning to spend in this bank?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. He gets his bag filled up with some money, and it's really just the money from the cash drawers. Although the letters, the notes, say, I want $250,000 and then in certain denominations and blah, blah, blah. If they actually would have followed the instructions on the notes, he might have been there for a good 15 minutes while they did this, maybe 20. But instead, they just stuff money haphazardly into his bag and sent him on his way. And I think he made out with around $8,000 is all.
Now, this letter he handed over, didn't it explicitly state that they were not to put any kind of device in with the money to, you know, like they have those bombs that go off and just splatter ink everywhere. They were told, don't try to sabotage this, essentially.
Well, yeah, it's explaining that he has a bomb around his neck and it can be detonated remotely. It is on a timer, so he's on a schedule here. Again, I go back to the long rambling notes and think, if you have a bomb on a timer, wow, you want to get this job done. And here Brian is, after he gets his bag filled up, sort of spinning his cane gun around and sort of moseying on out of the bank like Charlie Chaplin, right?
Yeah, there's not a lot of rush on his part.
He doesn't seem agitated or any sense of urgency, which that's weird to me.
It costs him, right? Well, I say it costs him as if he's the one behind this.
The next piece of his little scavenger hunt is go to McDonald's, find the planter or something outside, and he's literally having to find the next clue where to go to find keys to get this bomb collar off of his throat. But after he goes to McDonald's, which is literally just like right there next to the bank, he pulls out onto the road and there's the cops waiting for him because, well, when you rob a bank, they are right there. It takes minutes, right?
I believe it's the state police as well.
Yeah. And they blockade him in and he actually is very compliant. He explains to them, hey, there's a bomb around my neck. And, you know, when he has his hands up and all that, and the cops go over and they lift up that shirt with the guess on it, and they see what they believe is a bomb. They handcuff him behind his back, and then they back away. Now, there's some discussion on whether or not the police believed that this was a real bomb or not, but it doesn't really matter because they're going to treat it as a real bomb. Regardless.
Right. And I think that's just the smart thing to do. They call for the bomb squad, but the bomb squad, despite being on the way, has their own set of challenges.
Well, they're 10 miles away and they've shut down the road to, you know, McDonald's or whatever. So there's this huge traffic jam because this is the main strip, I guess, in Erie, or at least a main thoroughfare. And the bomb squad now is stuck in traffic. So it's taking them even longer to get to Brian, who now is, I guess you could say he's pleading with the police to take off his handcuffs and try to get to the next point to get the key so he can get the collar off of his neck.
Listening to him plead, though, I got the sense that he was almost more interested in just continuing on with the scavenger hunt rather than trying to say, hey, I'm going to die here.
Yeah, he again, there's no real sense of urgency. There's no panic. It's just, hey, guys, take these handcuffs off, and we really need to get to the next spot because this thing's going to go off.
Yeah, he was saying, you know, look at the letters, look at the notes. We need to get the keys.
And he's saying it in about that tone.
If I had a bomb around my neck and it was going to go off, I think I'd be very, very panicked. This guy is not panicked.
I wouldn't have stopped the car. I would have just driven to the next point. You can shoot me. That's cool because I would rather be shot down than have a bomb explode around my neck. That just doesn't seem like the best way to go. but he's complying with the police officer's orders.
Justin, you talked about how he let them know that he had a bomb on him, and then we don't really know if the police believed it or not, even though they were calling for the bomb squad. But once the beeping started, I think that's when they really knew for sure that this was an actual bomb.
At least when you hear a beeping, which is signifying a countdown of some sort, they definitely got back a few more yards because they don't, we've all seen those action movies. It's not a good thing. And sadly, this device detonates, killing Brian Wells. Now, he's not killed instantly. He survives for at least a few more minutes until the bomb squad arrives. But what a horrible way to die, knowing that you have a bomb around your neck and you can't get it off because it almost looks like a huge handcuff. So it has multiple keyholes on the front, wiring, a cell phone, and all kinds of instructions on, you know, warnings on what you can and can't do to this device.
So thinking about that, because they collect all the pieces of this bomb or as much as they can, and it's over 90% of it, they're able to reconstruct what this device was. And it wasn't really designed in a way, given the amount of time that he had, to be disabled, right?
No.
When you look at this, how do you say that this guy did this, right? I mean, this is almost like, well, let's just go to what they find in his car. Inside of his car, they find instructions for the bomb hostage.
Yeah. He has his own set of instructions.
Which means that at the very least, he's not the guy that orchestrated this whole thing.
No, he's part of something bigger. And whether or not he is a pawn in it being used or somewhat of a willing participant, we're not sure. But I looked at his behavior, at least, in the bank. And even when he's at gunpoint with the police officers, and I'm thinking he acts like he's part of this and he knew something about this, especially when you hear about the phone call to the restaurant and he took over the phone call to find this address, which was a abandoned building out in the woods. I don't know if I would be delivering pizza there, but maybe he thought it was an active antenna array.
Yeah, it just seems like an odd place to send someone to with pizzas.
Also, when the police officers ask him, hey, what happened? What is this bomb around your throat? He actually says, some black guys kidnapped me and put this thing on my neck and sent me out on this wild goose chase. Well, we'll find out later that that's a lie. And given it was in his notes for the bomb hostage to say that, and I don't know how I would behave with a bomb strapped around my neck, but again, it's one more detail that seems to place him in cahoots with this plan.
Well, but if he followed the instructions on this, I'll call it a letter, for the bomb hostage to rob this bank, then why wouldn't he follow all of the other instructions in that letter?
I figure when I have 12 cops with their guns trained on me and I've just robbed a bank, all bets are off as far as the instructions go, but that's just me. That's how I would behave.
Brian said that the bomb could be remotely detonated, right?
Yeah.
So wouldn't he think that maybe if he deviates from the plan that it will be detonated? I'm just trying to say I could see where he would keep following the instructions so that he wouldn't die.
I know that I would deviate from the instructions, but then again, I'm not really an instruction follower myself. So, meanwhile, the police have already called his place of work, Mama Mia's Pizzeria, and are interviewing his coworkers. One of his coworkers, Robert Panetti, started behaving sort of, I guess, unnaturally. He started becoming very paranoid and complaining to his fellow coworkers that they're coming after me now. The lead investigators asked Robert to interview with them, and he
I guess he was so freaked out that he said, no, we have to push back until Monday. Well, that Sunday night, they will find Robert's body after a fatal overdose, and he will not make it to that interview on Monday.
Where did they find Robert?
They found his body at his house. Now, it is speculated whether or not this was a accidental overdose or a suicide, as if he didn't want to deal with the mounting pressure, so he took a lethal dose of drugs to off himself. Or he was just doing drugs and this was totally an accident.
But what you just told us, though, is that he felt like they were coming for him next.
Yeah. Well, they were law enforcement and they did want to interview him, but did he have any information? He was friends with Brian, but that doesn't mean he was in on a bank heist. So it's weird.
Well, yeah. And this is where you can speculate. Either Brian told him something about what he was going to be doing, so he felt like, uh-oh, I have information. They're going to want to talk to me. I could have this pinned on me as well. Or maybe he's just a paranoid individual. And because of how big this is, it was too much for him. Because this is big. I mean, how often do you hear about a guy with some kind of large bomb on his chest? I mean, it's manacled around his throat. And I can only imagine the kind of pressure he was under if he was worried that somehow he might be tied to it.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
So the investigation is stalled at this point. They don't have much because they're looking at the bomb, they're looking at the instructions, they're profiling who they think would be behind this. Somebody that wants control, obviously.
Well, control is right. I mean, think about the rambling letters and how much information is being conveyed when it seems unnecessary. That's a lot of control.
This scavenger hunt that he was on was going to send him to an exit off the highway, but this was not going really away from the bank robbery. And then the next step was going to take him back towards the bank robbery, and he was going to go on this full circle around town, not jumping on an interstate and getting out of town, which would be the normal, I guess, normal actions to get away from a bank robbery.
So if you think about all that, that this device wasn't really meant to be disabled given the amount of time that he actually had. And then he's making a circle and not getting away from the area where he robbed the bank. This is almost like someone set him up to die on purpose.
Absolutely. I 100% believe that. And later on during our interview, you'll hear the director's opinions on that also. But this is a wild goose chase. It's not even a scavenger hunt anymore. When they were going to one of the drop points or places on the scavenger hunt for Brian, the investigator saw a blue minivan pretty much fleeing the scene, but he was far away enough that he couldn't catch up to the minivan. A man named Bill Rothstein will call the police and tell them that he has a body and a deep freeze cooler in his garage, and that his girlfriend told him to dispose of said body. Not a normal phone call, and police, of course, respond with caution. But Bill, I would say he socially disarms them. He does not physically disarm the police, but he says, hey, here's the body, here's my house, and he takes them on a little escapade tour of his whole property and gives them too much information in order to put them at ease. And most of this information is about his girlfriend,
Marjorie Deal Armstrong.
It takes the police a little bit of time, though, to go through his house because he's a hoarder. There's stuff piled to the ceiling. Meanwhile, he's given them all this information about Marjorie, so they have to go to her house and question her. This body in his freezer is James Roden, who is an ex-boyfriend of Marjorie. He had been shot in the face with a shotgun and then placed in this freezer. And for whatever reason, Bill decided he no longer wanted to be part of this and no longer wanted to assist Marjorie in the disposal of the body. Now, I don't want to go too much into a lot of these characters' past, but Marjorie has a history of all of her exes meeting mysterious demises, I guess, or something to that effect. They either have died from accidental deaths or she's murdered them. Her ex-husband that she murdered, she actually was charged with that crime, but then found incompetent to stand trial. And so she went to a psychiatric hospital for many years and was released. So we have a interesting dynamic here between her and Bill, because Bill is very close to her, but very much alive. And Marjorie has a history of apparently killing off her ex-boyfriends and husbands.
But the question we will keep going back to is, who was behind this plot?
And we have Marjorie, who wanted to inherit her father's estate, which was worth almost $2 million.
Well, she believed it was almost $2 million. I think she thought it was $1.8 million.
Yeah.
But it was actually $1 million, which it's still a good amount of money.
So her motivations, if you take her as being an accessory to this whole bank heist, is she wanted money to pay a hitman to knock her father off so she could get the inheritance. So knock over a bank to pay a hitman with that money to get more money. Meanwhile, you have Bill Rothstein, who was trying to sell his house and get like a second mortgage and sort of posturing himself to get $250,000, which is the exact same amount that is asked on the banknote. Also, he was doing a charity event of some type where he was, again, trying to scam money. So he has the same amount in his ask as what the banknote has. Also, the instructions, the notes that Brian Wells had on him are very similar to notes and instructions that they find at Bill Rothstein's house. So we have a connection there. And sorry, but I forgot to mention that Bill's house happens to be right next to that abandoned antenna array where that pizza was delivered and Brian had a collar put around his throat with a bomb. They trace the phone call to Mama Mia's to a payphone at a local Shell station, which was not too far away. And we have a witness that says they saw a woman with a likeness to Marjorie driving
the wrong way down the highway at an excessive rate of speed. There are other players in this, but really, that's the setup. And there are lots of rabbit holes to go down, but Aaron and I just question, who do we think is behind this, and who has the most culpability in this diabolical bank heist? It's really between Bill and Marjorie, I guess.
Legally, I think they, you know, the law looks at this and just says, well, hey, if you're a part of it, you're a part of it. Right?
Who's the mastermind?
Right. And that's the evil genius. I think the title's kind of funny because I didn't get the sense, having seen these notes, these letters, that this was a genius plot. I'm sure it took a lot of time and planning, but I don't know. I would say any good criminal isn't going to give away that much information. They're going to give you very little information. How long do you have to read these letters and notes to get everything down? And I think that may be part of the reason why they just threw all the money that was readily available at the bank, which amounted to about $8,000, instead of giving him the $250,000, because I think it was TLDR. I think it was just like, just get this done, you know, give him the money, get him out of here.
That means too long didn't read, if for anyone that doesn't know current internet slang.
Well, actually, that one might have been around a while. But yeah, it's, I mean, who's going to sit around and try to read this long document to figure out what they're supposed to do? There's a bomb in the building. I don't want to be in a building with a bomb. I think the bank did the right thing. Give him some immediate cash and get him out the door. But that's, again, it's, to me, it's not genius. I will say that they recreate this bomb so they get an understanding of what all went into it. And I'd say it's a pretty well-made bomb.
Well, yeah, it didn't go off the way they expected it, but it had pieces of metal that were scored that were supposed to shrapnel out, but that didn't happen. And there was a lot of misdirection with the bomb. The cell phone did nothing. A bunch of the wires on the bomb were just wires wrapped around gears.
If you watch Evil Genius, you'll see the bomb, the reconstruction of the bomb, down the left side when you open the panel. It has all of these instructions and warnings about don't do this and don't do that, because basically you're going to set this bomb off. And so it could be very intimidating, or at least slow down anyone who's trying to disable it. So I think the smartest thing I've seen in this whole plot is actually the bomb itself. So the question comes up, who could have made this bomb? I mean, could Marjorie have made it?
No.
Yeah, we don't think so.
I think Bill has the skill set. He appears to have a machinist background, and the instructions on the bomb and the instructions found at his house have a lot of similarities.
When you talk about culpability, putting this whole plot together requires someone who can build a bomb and write all these extensive notes. We could say Marjorie probably didn't write the letters, right?
No.
But one of the things that comes up is that whoever wrote the letters may have copied from printed letters, right? Like they were almost trying to trace, not really trace, but just like write over. And that, I guess, would be a way to obscure handwriting possibly, or at least take something that was typewritten and then handwrite it out.
Yeah. They were able to find other information and evidence from impressions on other pieces of paper, other writings. So the plot thickens.
So in other words, you could say, yeah, maybe Bill made the bomb. Maybe Bill wrote these letters, but perhaps he was writing the letters based on stuff that was written by Marjorie.
Or
typewritten by Marjorie.
Yeah, it's very possible. I guess I look at it and I still focus on Bill because of the amount asked for. And it seems to be an amount that he was looking for in previous scams that he was working.
But here's another problem I have with this whole situation. The investigators are having trouble figuring out who was behind this, because even if they believe that Brian was a part of it, he was not the genius behind it. And they're having trouble with that. Now, granted, it's only a month into the investigation, but it's because Bill Rothstein calls in and says, hey, I've got a body that's the ex-boyfriend of my current girlfriend in my deep freeze. Without that call, what do they have?
Nothing.
So why would he sabotage his own freedom. He's basically waving a big flag and saying, hey guys, over here.
Well, back to your genius comment. You can say that these people aren't geniuses, but I feel like they're the smartest ones in the room. And Bill Rothstein will actually tell an FBI agent, I'm the smartest one in the room here. I think it's pure arrogance, but who knows? Maybe he had a lapse of judgment and had feelings for the day and decided I'm going to call the police about this body, but I'm so good, I'm going to outsmart the police and the investigators, and they won't be able to attach me to that bank heist, which just seems stupid. But I think they overthought all of this, especially with their notes.
Yeah, overthinking is definitely what I would see here too. It just seems like there's too much being put into this. It's not necessary. If you're pulling off a crime, you don't need to put out this much information because you'll end up saying or doing or writing the wrong thing.
Now, Marjorie, I absolutely feel had a hand in this because she has a hand in everything. And once you watch the documentary, you'll understand what I mean. She's manipulating everybody around her and forming her own reality around her. So she's in control. So right there, she's a control freak. Maybe she's the one that is manipulating Bill.
So my final thoughts, Justin, are that, you know, there's always this debate over Brian Wells's complicity in this. I mean, is he culpable? Is he part of this plot? If you take his very casual demeanor the whole time, his antisocial behavior, to me, it all adds up to a guy who was either tricked into participating or forced into participating, and he never really understood what was happening. Not to a level that we think he should have understood. Do you know what I mean? So how is this guy considered part of the plot from a culpability standpoint if he's acting so casual and this whole thing was set up to kill him?
Yeah, unless it was proven that he made the bomb and this whole thing was his plan to rob a bank and then the plan blew up in his face, quite literally, then I would say he's culpable. But the fact that other people were involved and he didn't want to die, I have to give him a pass.
Justin, you interviewed Trey Borzalieri and Barbara Schroeder.
Yeah, they were an absolute joy to talk to. And they have a lot of insights, kind of behind the scenes things that we talked about for Evil Genius. And again, I highly recommend people watch the documentary, because if you don't know what's going on, this conversation's going to kind of go over your head. And as much as me and you just set up the best we could, we did not go into the level of detail of the trials, of the backgrounds on a lot of these people that this documentary does. So without further ado.
Can you hear us, Justin?
Yes, I can. How you guys doing?
Hi, Justin. Barbara.
Hey.
Hi, Justin.
Sorry, I was having a little difficulty. My phone wasn't ringing, so I just decided to call you guys.
Good move.
Yeah.
Good plan B.
Awesome. When did you guys decide this was the story you wanted to cover for this documentary?
So, I mean, the long story of it, you know, dates back to in 1996 when I had seen the first Paradise Lost. It just blew me away. So I was looking for a story. I was really inspired to try to create something like that. And then by coincidence, in 2003, on August 28th, I was in my hometown, Buffalo, New York. The evening news had on a report about Brian Wells. And basically, they were reporting that this a bank robber had used a live device to rob a bank, and that the device had gone off, killing him.
Yeah.
So stared at it and was like, why, how, you know, what are the desperate lengths that robbers are willing to go to today to wear a live bomb? You know, soon it trickled out that there was evidence at the scene that indicated that Wells could have been forced to do it. And it just opened up this huge mystery. And for me, that was the day. You know, it was really that day that it happened. You know, went after it, you know, did interviews, tried to, capture every major beat in the case. And in 2013, there were still remaining questions, even after the federal trial of Marjorie Deal Armstrong. Mm-hmm. So I reached out to Barbara. I had seen a great documentary of hers called Tall Hot Blonde. And I spoke with her, and thankfully she came on board, and, you know, we became partners seeking deeper truths in this case.
Okay. Well, and interestingly, Justin, I had seen a documentary, too, that kind of set me on the path of doing documentaries, and it was Grey Gardens. Have you ever seen that one or heard about that one?
I've heard of it, but I've never watched it.
Well, it's a great, and it was made into like a Broadway play and a movie, and it's this great character study of these two women, Big Edie and Little Edie, who are just, they jump off the screen, and they have mental illness, but yet are compelling to watch. And I'd always been looking for a character like that, and when Trey came and showed me everything that he had gotten together, he was just such a citizen journalist that was, what he had done, his instincts were amazing, and he had conversations with this woman, Marjorie Deal Armstrong, and I thought, oh my God, this is one of those stories where you have a potential mastermind, and she's a female, and she's entertaining, but she's wildly, she's scary, you know, at times. I mean, Trey endured years of talking to this person who just badgered him and occasionally would say, you know, love ya at the end of phone calls too. So,
oh, and slightly off topic, you did Tall Hot Blonde, right? Which,
yeah.
Yeah, I love that one. That was true crime before it was cool.
Thank you. Yeah, and it was right around the same time that the catfish movie came out. So it was like the time for. But the similarity is that it also involved a female protagonist who did something pretty heinous, and so that's the similarity there. I'm intrigued with work that involves unusual characters who are, you know, the primary characters, and also was very just so impressed with the work that Trey had done. I thought, I'm a seasoned journalist and Trey's a citizen journalist, and he blew me away. Like, I'd rather work with him than most of my other colleagues.
That's awesome. How did you guys meet up? How did you sync up?
Yeah, Barbara had come recommended to me from a few industry people, and I just reached out to her one evening, and I think we were together either later that night or the next day.
I remember Trey said, the story is very complex, it's very complicated, be careful because, you know, you might go down the rabbit hole because there are so many angles to this. And sure enough, you know, you start in on this case and you go down all these rabbit holes of, you know, evidence and questions that still remain, because technically this was an FBI major case that was technically closed.
Yeah.
But it was still unsolved in a lot of ways for us and for Trey primarily, because it's like, wait a minute, who built the bomb? The investigators can't tell you for sure who built the bomb, although, you know, they have a good idea. They couldn't tell you for sure who the mastermind was or who decided to make that bomb live. And then most interesting and most intriguing of all was the question of the level of this poor pizza guy's involvement.
Mm-hmm. I have to admit that when I watched it, you know, he goes into the bank. He seems very calm. He has a cane gun. And he also tells authorities that, you know, this random made-up story of how he found himself in this situation. So my knee-jerk reaction is, this guy's in on it. He's part of it. I guess when you try to put yourself in that situation, you think, well, why would he have a gun on him? Why would he give a fake story? But then you think, well, how would I behave with a bomb around my neck?
Well, and keep in mind that he didn't have a high intellect. Brian was kind of a, as somebody in the documentary describes, he's kind of a pushover, and he was a loner. Trey, you had some good descriptions of
Yeah, him. I mean, it was, to my knowledge, he's more antisocial. You know, I think he was, you know, a smart guy. I don't know, you know, he was fragile.
Yeah.
And he was targeted for a specific reason. He was targeted as someone that could be, you know, potentially a target and victim of this bizarre crime. And there was planning that went into selecting him. It wasn't, you know, doesn't appear to be that this was a random call to a pizza, you know, a pizza delivery, and it turned into this.
Yeah.
So, you know, you factor that in, and then, you know, like you, you know, my initial reaction to it was I thought that he was involved, and I did for a good long while. But because I was able to get in early, my point of view evolved over the course, you know, this long journey, this 10-year journey. And that's how, you know, how it, ended up. It was, my opinion evolved.
Well, and I guess my opinion evolves while I'm watching it. And when you get to the part where, how was he supposed to do all these things, these tasks, and make it out alive?
That was one of the most intriguing parts of this, that not only was he latched into a bomb, it was like a big handcuff around his neck, and then it was welded to a box that had the actual pipe bombs inside of it, you know, with warnings written on it. Not only was he put into that bomb, but then he was supposed to go rob the bank, give the money to the people, the masterminds or co-conspirators, and then he was supposed to, if he wanted to live, they said you have to go on a scavenger hunt to try to find keys to unlock the bomb. I mean, this is what makes it, you know, the most diabolical bank heist in the FBI's words, mm-hmm. That it had these extra layers to it. And were you able to see some of the read some of those notes that were in the series?
Yeah.
Bank hostage notes, mm-hmm. and were those intriguing to you?
Yeah, and I guess when it comes down to that is, did they actually think that they were going to be successful in getting money out of this bank? I mean, if the bank robber or designated person isn't even going to live through the process, I just think, was this a planned murder, or did they actually think they were going to get away with a bank heist?
Yeah, and, you know, that's exactly sort of how, you know, it evolves when you take a deeper look at this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there's a variety of motivations. You know, the FBI, when they began to profile who they deemed the mastermind, they referred to the mastermind as the collar bomber. Mm-hmm. They started to take, you know, all this into account, and, you know, it starts to look more like a pre-planned murder, a terrorist act, than perhaps a bank robbery. And so, you know, that's how this mystery, you know, grows, and it really just becomes an unbelievable whodunit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just can't, the series of events are so shocking and captivating that you can't help but fall, you know, succumb to it.
And it's such an interesting way to look inside these people's minds, these co-conspirators. Like, when you look at those notes, there were 9 notes in total. Mm-hmm. There was one for Brian. It was labeled bomb hostage. There was a note for the bank teller. There was a note for the bank manager, which said things, evil things, like, we know where your families live, you better go to the vault and get this money as quickly as possible. And they delineated that we want X number of 50s and X number of 100s. I mean, it was just convoluted. And then there was even a note for police, a hostage note, a note that the yeah. co-conspirators wrote for police that said, do not think you can outsmart us. We're, you know, stand down. I mean, the bravado, the hubris of these co-conspirators was, you know, reflected in those notes, was just mind-boggling.
Yeah, they were so threatening. Mm-hmm. And it was threatening to the bank, to the bomb hostage as well. You know, go away from the script or the path of instructions. We can detonate remotely. So threatening. And you know, most of the public, I mean, very few people have seen the notes in their entirety. That's why we're going to be releasing them soon. And so we're really excited about that.
Just going through some of the notes that you guys reveal, I couldn't follow all those instructions myself in a 55-minute time frame. In working in a corporate environment, most people don't read after the first line of an email. So 9 pages of instruction is, to me, it definitely is a suicide or homicide mission. There's no good outcome here.
Yeah. And it's part of the mystery. Like, mm-hmm. How would anybody, whether they were intelligent, slow, whatever, how would anybody be able to follow those instructions while under the duress of having a live bomb attached to you? And it's possible that Brian didn't know it was live. It's, you know, these are still, I mean, how is it that an FBI major case still has so many unanswered questions?
Yeah. Do you think it was Rothstein or Armstrong that was the bigger manipulator in this?
Good question. I mean, I was interviewing Jason Wick, our ATF expert, who was involved early on in the case. And I asked him, you know, who do you think the mastermind was? And he laid it out. He said, we really can't tell you for sure. So we have our personal opinions, but we want to leave it in the documentary so that people will have their own journey, because we don't know for sure. We just have opinions. Mm-hmm. We can't tell you for sure.
Yeah, and there's, you know, remember, you've got 4 main co-conspirators at the core of this, mm-hmm. and they're all crafty, you know, most of them by and large are smart, and they're veteran criminals. The motivations, you know, vary. You know, we don't know for sure who was motivated for what reason. You know, while the crime takes on different levels and seems to be motivated by different factors, it's the same when it comes to those core four co-conspirators. You know, maybe individually they had different motives.
Justin, were you surprised, or what did you think when you saw all the photos of the hoarders, of the hoarding that was going on? Because these co-conspirators, like three of them, were intense hoarders.
I was about to ask you about that, actually. I thought, how could this person plan such an elaborate heist when they're so disorganized? But at the same time, I have family members with mental illness and issues, and I know that they know where a lot of this stuff is. They are very organized inside their head, but the physical world might not be so organized. So I guess that's how I looked at it, is I thought, how could these people plan this? But then I thought, well, I know people that are like this, and they are very capable. I don't know. I thought it was odd that all of them were hoarders, though.
Yeah, that was our elevator pitch at one point. Three hoarders, a convicted child molester, and, you know, a hooker orchestrated a robbery that outplayed the FBI for quite a while.
Yeah. Do you think the documentary stigmatizes mental illness at all, or those living with it, as being manipulative or destructive?
Oh, we sure hope it doesn't, because we took great care with this. You know, we were very aware of the fact that we were dealing with, and that Trey was talking to a woman who was mentally ill. And we did bring out, like, the before Marjorie Dale Armstrong, when she was considered the town beauty, when she was very smart. She'll tell you that she had four master's degrees. And we highlight the moment when her decline, her mental decline, actually begins, because we wanted to be empathetic. Like, this is not just put somebody on display who has mental illness. This is a journey to try and understand this woman and how many times she escaped the law and conviction on people that she had murdered because she used her mental illness as an excuse. So it was just this very complex person that we were trying to understand, as opposed to just saying, oh, here's a person who's mentally ill. Yeah. Listen to her talk. It was we always designed this so that it would be a journey into the mind of Marjorie Dale Armstrong.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
Do you think her upbringing had any bearing on this? I mean, it seemed that her parents enabled her to not get a job, enabled her to continue on a sort of a reckless lifestyle. Do you think that had anything to do with this?
Yeah, I think that's a fair take. It's troubling, you know, obviously, you know, yes. I mean, we wanted to present Marjorie in the right light. You know, she does step out as this huge character, you know, almost like an iconic villain. But, you know, we're always careful. You know, Marjorie, you know, looked at this as a platform for herself. She, in terms of her upbringing, it was, you know, she became a very self-centered person at some point in time. And, you know, she began to have fallout with her parents. It kept repeating itself. So, you know, there are cycles to Marjorie that you see, you know, in her personal life, in what became her criminal history, and then also in this case. You know, while she had, you know, a handful of these illnesses that she was dealing with, you know, she it just all kind of came together in her spirit for manipulation, you know. And she was, you know, so focused on, you know, getting her way. And, you know, obviously that must, you know, trace back to somewhere in the parenting and you know, her relationship with her parents as a child. You know, it's hard to put a finger on, but she was so impulsive, you know, and I think you can begin to see that in the series.
Yeah.
And she was impulsive to the point where it didn't matter. She would behave or take action in ways that even when they were detrimental to her. So she really couldn't control her impulsive nature. And, you know, you can see that in the series as well.
And by the way, the interview of Marjorie Dale Armstrong in the series, it's the first time that anybody's ever gotten her on camera. Yeah. People have wanted to interview her, and she's wanted to talk, but she's been in prison, she's been in jail, and so there was always that barrier. So this is the first time that, you know, people who are watching can have their own experience with her. And the backstory of how long Trey had to endure phone calls from her and her verbal onslaughts and her niceties as well. She would tell him, you know, she loves him at times, but the amount of work he put into this suspect, to getting information, I mean, years, and it paid off, you know, in a great way, because we got to some new truths in this.
Yeah.
And Trey, I do not envy you at all when it came to that. I have some family members that, one of them behaves almost exactly like Marjorie. And when she calls, I have to wait a good 20 minutes before I can get a word in. It's very similar.
She's best friends. Yeah, Marjorie was still probably talking when I hung up.
Yeah. But you do glean information out of this rant that, you know, the amount of editing and maneuvering you guys had to do to fit this into a cohesive idea for the documentary was just... I'm sure a mountain of an effort, and I applaud you for that, because I looked at all the letters, all the conversations you guys have, and it's really hard to get to the point with somebody who won't allow you to ask a question.
It's so true.
And it's so interesting that you brought up that you have a family member. A lot of people tell us and talk about how they know people that are similar to Marjorie, and she's a narcissist. She's bipolar. She's been diagnosed bipolar, and there's a kind of a theory. I'm not sure if it's like a legitimate medical theory, but there is a theory that if you are a narcissist / sociopath, that people like that feed on people that are empathetic. So, Justin, in your case, you're probably an empathetic person, and they call that an empath. So that relationship is very... it's common, and a lot of people tell us, oh, I have a relative, I have a, you know, somebody in my past who is kind of like this. And Marjorie takes it to an extreme, but it's just, you know, it's an interesting look into her mental health. And the fact that she used her mental health as a manipulative device to curry favor and to engender herself towards people, she would say, oh, I'm bipolar, I have my highs and I have my lows, and I'm not street smart, and she would try to get you on her side so that... if you're an empathetic person, you'd be like, oh, I'll understand you, Marjorie. I'll figure you out. I'll help you. And to watch how she does that to people,
yeah,
boyfriends, co-conspirators, Trey, I mean, it's just, I've never heard of or met a woman like this in all my years of journalism and interviewing criminals.
My family members might try to manipulate me, but they don't leverage their shortcomings to do that, which, thank God.
Yeah. She takes it to another level.
Yeah, and she would get so far out and so far ahead of some of this, you know, some of the information that she knew, or the investigation, she would get out in front of it and try to feed her version of the events back into it. That's how cunning, you know, she was.
Yeah, she would foreshadow, she would, like the theory about the inmates, how she would plant stories with the inmates.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, she would impregnate thought.
I like that term. It's planting the seed.
And then years later, Trey would realize, oh, that's why she said that, because she was trying to already set up her defense.
You know, believe me, I would have never imagined that this would have gone on this long in terms of, you know, the making of this. But when you get to the end, you know, it is just as shocking. It's hard to even say, but, you know, you get to the end and it's just as shocking as the beginning. And there were seeds planted all the way along, you know, that popped up throughout this journey, you know, that made the end of it all the more feasible.
And one example of that was so impressive, she had started telling Trey that, oh, these inmates, you know, they're going to lie and say things about me. And sure enough, the inmates came out later and said things about Marjorie that were true. Mm-hmm. And she already, like, been on the offensive to try and make sure these inmates didn't come across as credible.
Yeah. And when she's arrested, she's automatically telling the media, I'm going to sue these people. When she's in trial and there's a recess, she turns around and starts talking to the people in the audience and the media. And
she started talking to Trey. Tell that story. I love this story.
Yeah.
Oh, at the trial. Yeah. I mean, at the trial, I went in and I just walked in and sat on the prosecution side. And, you know, when the first break occurred, you know, she, you know, turns back and calls out, Trey, what are you doing over on the prosecution side? Get over here. And, you know, I certainly stood up and walked over. So, you know, that's Marge. Yeah. But she, you know, when you talk about trying to just instill your side of the story and, you know, your agenda, the Rodin case is a great example of that. In the series, you see how, you know, the bodies,
the guy in the freezer,
the guy, the frozen body, her live-in boyfriend at the time, you know, she immediately starts to try to point out that could be Bill's doing, you know, and so we see that process of her.
Yeah.
And, you know, she really put forth effort to try to, and then once, you know, once Bill dies, she tried to blame that on him for a majority of time. And, you know, I think that's a good example of her, you know, trying to manipulate.
Yeah. And I think that Bill does deserve a lot of the brunt here, because I feel that you guys did a good job with showing the notes, showing similar writing styles, and even when it came to the bomb making and whatnot, that seems like something he was far more capable of as opposed to Marjorie.
After watching it, who do you think was the mastermind? Do you think you can tell for sure?
I think Bill.
Yeah.
Just because he seemed to have his life a little bit more together, he seemed to have a lot more of the pieces. That's just my opinion, so I don't want anyone to be, you know, swayed by that. But he was the one that was asking for the money. He was the one that had knowledge of how to build and tinker with things. Obviously, Marjorie could have brought people together, organized people, even said, hey, you, go find me this, or go find me that, or go get a person. So I would see her as more of a project manager, but not the mastermind, I guess.
Good description.
It's good hearing you, you know, give your opinion, because that's exactly what we hope that, you know, we love the parlor game aspect of the story, where we were trying to create this participatory journey for the audience so they could play armchair detective.
Yeah.
And
that's the instinct. Like when Trey first brought all the great evidence that he'd collected, he'd gotten these, you know, videotapes from the Erie Police Department of the walkthrough in Bill Rothstein's house, which was like Hoarders times 10, to look at all this stuff. And then I read the notes for the first time. And there was a line in there in the note that really struck me. It was the line where it says, myself, my wife, and my partner are following you. And I thought, wait, who would write something like that? And then Trey started telling me about this love story that was behind it all, because Marjorie Dale Armstrong and Bill Rothstein had been engaged twice, and he was, I like to call him her jilted lapdog lover, because he would have done anything for her. And, you know, maybe incorporated into the note his secret wish of Marjorie being his wife. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are a lot of levels to this, to not just the case, but a lot of levels to all the evidence, too.
And I love the fact that you said he was the only man that was able to date her and live.
Yeah, that was our reporter that we relied heavily on for the story, Scott Bremner. He had that great line, like, he's the only guy who she didn't put in a freezer or knock off. And what does that say about him and her feelings for her? Because she, there were at least five men in her past who had died. One that she outright killed and admitted to killing, and then used a battered spouse. I'm sorry, yeah. We're on low sleep here from
you're good
to New York. So but she used the battered spouse excuse and got off on that murder. So she had a history, a dark, dark history of a lot of a string of dead lovers.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, there's an interesting little thing to share on that. When I first started knocking on doors in Erie, I leaned on a cousin that I have by the name of Lee Coppola, whose on-air nickname was the Troubleshooter in Buffalo, New York. You know, I began to get advice from him on these trips I would do to Erie. You know, maybe about, oh, like 3 years into it, he called me up and he said, you know, I've just had Marge Deal's name in my head for all these years and I just couldn't place it. He's like, you know, I did a story on Marge Deal back in 1980. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you got to be kidding. And he's like, yeah, she was involved in a fake abortion ring that was going on in between Erie and Buffalo. And there was a doctor in Buffalo, and obviously Marjorie was in Erie, and she was testing women who were coming in, you know, looking for a pregnancy test, and there was a little sting operation done by law enforcement there, and they uncovered that Marjorie was actually telling women that they were pregnant and sending them to Buffalo for abortions when they weren't pregnant at all.
So then they would just... knock them out and charge them some money. And
yeah, and so Trey had found out this information that even, you know, the local papers hadn't really picked up on again, that she had a criminal history way back when she just was out of college.
Wow.
She was running scams.
What do you think of, what does this reveal about our healthcare system when they let her out of the hospital after she murdered her boyfriend?
Yeah, I think that's one of the threads of this case. I wish we could have had an entire episode on just the whole mental health situation, because her attorney, Marge's attorney from the first time she killed a boyfriend, he tried during that first trial, he tried to put her away four times. And as he says so eloquently, four times the mental health system spit her out like Jonah in the whale, boom, out she came. But yet then he turned around and did his job and exonerated her, and the jury, you know, acquitted her from the charges. But it's easy to go to the mental health system failed here. But I think it's important to point out that the mental health system is also a victim of underfunding. And, you know, so we expect the mental health system to do a job that they sometimes aren't funded for. So it's almost like there's nobody, you can't pin the blame on anybody specifically. You can't say it was Marjorie's parents, who didn't really realize how bad her mental health was. They just wanted to, our only child, Marjorie, we love her. There's nothing wrong with her. You can't really say it's the mental health system solely responsible. It's a combination of all of these things that it's almost like lightning struck for Marjorie, and she was able to get away with a lot of stuff and wiggle her way out of a lot of stuff, and she skated through the justice system. I don't want to say it's almost admirable because it's so heinous what she did, but man, she was clever and she got lucky. Mm-hmm.
It was amazing to me to see how she was able to keep doing this over and over. I mean, we cover on the Generation Y, we cover husbands that murder their wives. And if they had a wife in a previous marriage that died under mysterious circumstances, we're like, yep, they're absolutely guilty on this one because of the past event. And here we are, she's murdered, or a lot of her past boyfriends have died due to whatever. And yet no one seems to be, I guess, looking at history, at her history, and saying, maybe there's something more to this and maybe we need to put her away or whatever. And it's eye-opening to me that whenever a case like this is put into the public's eye, it seems so clear to everybody. But when you're in the thick of it, when you're just the person at the hospital, when you're just the lawyer, when you're just the judge, you're only seeing one piece of this person's life.
Yeah, I mean, the mental health thing definitely was, you know, one of the top societal issues that I hope that, you know, we could spawn conversations about, you know, from day one. Mm-hmm. And I hope that we can in some way. And, you know, in terms of with Marjorie, it's like, you know, what would have happened if she had never been found competent to stand trial? Would that have meant that she would have stayed in a mental health institution, you know, for forever? You know, what would it have meant? And you know, I'd like to know, you know, in some professionals that I've spoken to recently in the in mental health, they don't even know, you know, what it is that determines whether or not someone is competent for trial. You know, it's this touch and go thing that happened to her twice. And it's something that we need to talk about, because there's probably plenty of situations going on right now where the same thing is happening.
Well, and it's Brian Wells' family, you know, they look at the fact that had Marjorie been put in a mental institution or been treated properly or, you know, ended up in prison the rest of her life, after she killed her first boyfriend, a lot of other men would still be alive, let alone their beloved brother, Brian Wells.
And I don't understand how somebody can be found incompetent once and then competent later. I mean, they're the same person.
It's called restoring someone to competency, yeah. And that's what happened. Marjorie would be declared incompetent to stand trial. She'd go into to a mental health institution within the prison system, and they would give her therapists. They would give her medication, and she actually didn't like medication. She hated taking pills, right, Trey?
Was yep.
she against? Yeah. But and then she was deemed competent, and you were surprised, weren't you, when she was?
Oh, for her federal trial, anybody that I spoke to believed that she was not going to be deemed competent and that the trial would never happen. And then out of the blue, it happened.
Hmm. Gets up on the stand. Most defense attorneys don't put a completely sane person on the stand. But Marjorie wanted to tell her story, and I'm sure she badgered her attorney, Doug Shugrue, to say, you know, let me up there. And I don't know if you caught a lot of this in the episode where we go over the trial, but she, even the jury could, and the court artists, they were kind of swayed when once Marjorie got on the stand, even though she was talkative and blustery and, you know, maybe seemed a little crazy, she convinced the courtroom artist to, not convinced, but she, her demeanor on the stand caused the courtroom artist to change the way he was drawing Marjorie. He wanted to draw her with dark eyes and evil. And then as she testified and as she became more human and as people, you know, got to hear her tell stories and become conversational, they started thinking, oh, maybe, you know, maybe she's not so bad after all. And he started drawing her softer and sweeter. What an effect she had on her trial by testifying yeah. when everybody thought she ruined it, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she was working the crowd. She was working everybody in that courtroom. She had such attitude. She had such personality, even though it was very dark. She had a lot of personality and a lot of dark humor. And, you know, leading up to that, leading up to her testimony, I actually visited her right before it in prison. And, you know, she was talking to me and, you know, asking, you know, what my thoughts were of the trial so far. And she started really leaning in on her father, you know, because the government's motive for this crime is that Marjorie was planning to have a hitman kill her father in order for her to get her inheritance. And so,
and
you know,
she needed money for the hitman.
She wanted to rob the bank to get the money to pay for the hitman. You know, and even that is, it's a convoluted motive.
Yeah.
So I'm in prison with her and, you know, we're talking and she starts to really lean in on her father. She said, well, you know, give me your advice. And I said, well, I mean, are you planning on giving testimony that is so derogatory about your dad and the relationship? And she said, I just want it to be real. I want it to be real. You know, that kind of touches back to that impulsive nature to her that I mentioned before. She did things even though she knew that it was, you know, detrimental to her situation.
Yeah, yeah. And getting on the stand is usually a bad idea. Yet she was able to work it. I mean,
work it. And then, you know, not only that, but get up there and, you know, give this very dark version of her relationship with her dad, which just, you know, made people think, well, you know, maybe you were trying to plot to kill your father
yeah.
since you hate him so much.
It was one of her Marjorie-isms where she'll say, why would I pay somebody to kill my father when I've killed boyfriends myself and I would do it for free? Which, these mind-boggling, she was a soundbite machine because she would say these, you know, who says something like that?
I know.
Yeah, and then she followed up with, there's only 2% of Americans that would ever kill their parents. I'm not one of those 2%.
it's contradictions in the same breath, but she's playing off of these,
I guess, impressions of her. She's of the media's, you know, reporting of her, and she knows how to manipulate it. She knows how to get a laugh or get a shock, and she does it. I would never want to mentally spar with her or debate her. I would lose horribly. It's just...
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that. You know, it's like the way the two of them are just, you know, are described by those who knew them, you know, Bill and Marge. You know, it's like both of them were always just looking for a flaw in somebody that they could then spin around and take to their advantage. Mm-hmm. That was their MO.
Marjorie could also be funny at times, and she would like... Marjorie liked it when people kind of poked fun at her, in a way. There was a moment where, it's not in the documentary, but there was a moment where our state trooper that we worked with, Dave Gluth, was in a car with Marjorie, and there were two of, there was, I think, an ATF guy and an FBI guy as well. They were taking her around to the different sites in the heist and the scavenger hunt, saying, hey, what did you see? What do you know? And they were talking about the men in her life. Marjorie kind of took a liking to Dave Gluth, and she seemed to talk to him more than the other investigators. And at one point, somebody pointed that out, and Dave said to Marjorie, he said, Marjorie, no offense, but guys you take a liking to don't last very long. And Marjorie laughed, and she loved it when people, you know, called her on her stuff, and probably in a way she was, like, proud of it, too. I mean, it was a weird sense of humor, but she wasn't above, you know, laughing at things like that.
Well, I know people that they don't respect you if you don't stand up to them. If they can walk all over you, they lose respect for you. But as soon as you fight back, they're like, ah, that's the person I was looking for. She very much exhibits that.
You know, think about this. We were just talking about the personalities and them looking for flaws and flipping it on people and trying to use to their advantage. And I can't help but think back on our conversation about Brian Wells's culpability earlier. And you think about it, you know, if we think about him as being completely innocent, and then we think about the fact that they were looking for a specific type of person. I mean, you know, if it is true that he was innocent, I mean, look at the way they executed, you know, their handling of Brian Wells.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to Brian, I'm a little on the fence just because there was, I guess, so many things that I thought, why would somebody do that? Go into a bank holding a gun. And the whole, he liked scavenger hunts, and then he's put on one. Things like that, I think, well, how would he not have a hand in this? And, you know, I guess my knee-jerk reaction is he absolutely was involved. And then it softened to, well, maybe he thought he was going along with this, but he didn't know the bomb was real. He didn't know these other things were going to happen. And by the end of it, I'm thinking... especially after you speak with the eyewitness. It's like, okay, he could have been manipulated. And then when you show how manipulative all these people are and how they can influence people, it's not as far-fetched.
Right, and keep in mind that in episode 4 with this eyewitness who comes forward for the first time, I mean, the case had been closed and put to bed 3 years, you know, hence. Mm-hmm. That an eyewitness who was an elusive eyewitness, the FBI talked to her for a little bit, tried to talk to her more, but she lawyered up and then she shut up. They weren't able to talk to her. Trey stayed in touch with her and was able to get new information from her that I think it's fair to characterize that all the investigators that are involved in this are very surprised to hear this confession that people can see in episode 4, because it is new information that has never, you know, light has never been shed on this new information before until Trey, using his relationship with people and working those sources, which is just such good journalism. Now, we need more of that in the world today, but, you know, to get new information that the FBI couldn't get, that's pretty powerful. And the way she knew that she could be charged once she did this interview with us, but she did the interview anyway. And Trey, you have a great, I love how you describe how she was just, had to come forward. And
speaking with a lot of retired law enforcement and also active law enforcement, you know, for a conspiracy case like this, it is common for people years later to come forward, you know, with revelations, new information. You know, it's a common thing for these kind of conspiracies. And so, you know, for her specifically, you know, this was, you know, what were her motivating factors? This was something that she carried for a very long time, you know, to quote her, eating her up inside, and wanted to cleanse her conscience. There was a, you know, breadcrumb trail to this information. You know, as you get to learn more and more about the case, it doesn't come to be that shocking.
And when it comes to, you know, somebody that's a sex worker, uses drugs, you know, all of these different aspects, and shame of being manipulated, shame of, oh, I might have had a hand in this terrible event, I can see why she wouldn't want to talk at
first.
Yeah,
well, there wasn't a benefit to her talking, as far as she didn't get any money for it. You know, a lot of people think she's a horrible person now, but I hope that she sees that she's kind of a hero in all this, because she did come forward and tell a truth that has never been told before, which, as Trey says so eloquently, it's kind of a second chance at justice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, in terms of, you know, I've been asked a lot of how do you get, you know, obsessed with a case, you know, like this, and mm-hmm. obviously your viewers, you know, they know it's easy to become obsessed, you know,
yeah.
when you're seeking answers in a great whodunit. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as you carry on further, once you start to realize who the players are, we just instinctively want more information. You know, we want to know why, not only who was responsible, but we want to know why.
Yeah.
And so there was a, you know, great period of time in the journey where it was just chasing the why, trying to understand such a bizarre crime.
And it's sad because at the end of it, you are almost left with more questions, because or you're left with, this whole thing was just set up for failure, because you kind of get a why, you get the players, you get some of their motivations, but they all have different motivations. And then you find out that the whole plan probably would have failed anyways, even if they had gotten past that, you know, first piece. And it's just like, what were you thinking? And I struggle with the why again, because I'm like, how would they think that this was a good idea, or that this was the best way to do it? But I think it comes down to, you know, this joke with developers. It's like you ask a developer for something and then they give you something completely different. And a lot of the players in this case are too intelligent for their own good. and sending an email with one sentence asking a question is far more efficient than sending a 10-page email with very
right.
specific instructions to 9 different people. You know.
Yeah, and you can't, you know, just playing off of what you said, you know, it's like we keep going and, you know, it's like root down in there, you know, in the motivations of this crime. Who was motivated to turn this into a public execution, you know, like we've never seen before?
And if it was Bill Rothstein, how much hubris he had to sit in that state trooper barracks that first night he was interviewed, and to face an FBI agent who was asking him, hey, you're the frozen body you called in at your house. Isn't it ironic that it's right next to the tower site where Brian Wells delivered pizza? Are these two cases connected? And for Bill Rothstein's first words out of his mouth to be, I'm the smartest guy in the room. And maybe he knew that he was sick and that he was going to die. And he did die shortly thereafter. And there was a great interview that we had with a retired FBI agent. It didn't make it into the series. But he said, you know, maybe Rothstein left us with all of these questions. Maybe that was his grand plan to create something that would outwit, outsmart, and outplay law enforcement.
And I'm utterly amazed that they didn't indict him, too, that they didn't seek charges after him. But it was because they assumed he was being so forthcoming, right?
Oh, he used that to his advantage. You know, thou dost protest too much. He was like, you know, I'll tell you everything about the frozen body. But don't look at me for the bank heist, even though it happened right next door. And if you look at the interview with him and the way that he walks all these investigators, a room full of investigators, around his property, telling them all the details about the frozen body. I mean, he is holding court. He's like an instructor, like a professor walking around, you know, maybe completely manipulating the investigators so that they're not asking him about the real story. It's mind-boggling when you think about how much they plan in advance, probably, to try and outplay law enforcement.
And he had the note that said, this has nothing to do with the Brian Wells case. It's like,
yep. And it's all on the display there. Just him masterfully manipulating the investigators. And, you know, if, you know, step into this little pocket, you know, as to play the Wells case and pull it off the way that he did, leading up to when he calls in that frozen body, it's interesting to think that he may have overplayed himself, in the sense that he did something that maybe internally he couldn't handle, because, you know, as he started to approach that day that he called in the frozen body, you know, clearly the anvil of just the act that happened was falling down on him. And he was afraid of Marjorie. You know, why he had won at that point, if he had just gotten rid of that body, you know, they may never have caught them. And he didn't do that. And so there was a lot of weight on him. He may have overticked his coverage.
Yeah, and for this group of people to not be able to come up with an idea on how to dispose of a body, yet come up with this other elaborate scheme, I'm thinking, what? The back end of your house butts up against a whole forest.
Yeah. And to try to dazzle law enforcement with, oh, you know, I'm telling you everything. And it just was astonishing to see. I don't know. Was he masterful? Was he the mastermind? I don't know. Or did Marjorie put it up to him? Because she's like, you know. And the other thing I wanted to mention is law enforcement, I think because they were so, and dazzled is probably too great of a word, but they were so sidetracked by him that they never got to the bottom of, hey, Bill, why'd you put this guy in the freezer and leave him there? Like, why not just get rid of the body? And he would give them little excuses, but they never dug down deep to find out why in a freezer? Why not just, you know, put the body in a, you know, somewhere else? But it was, he had that body on ice for a reason, and we still don't know exactly why.
Yeah, I wonder if it's he wanted to use it as blackmail or leverage against Marjorie later.
Yeah, you know, all he had to do was get rid of it, and they all may have walked.
It's the one piece that could have let them or allowed them to get away with all of it, and it's amazing to me that they didn't do that. And I wondered why the officers didn't dig deeper with him, but I've seen it a zillion times where one person in the group turns on the rest of the group, and then they get, okay, you're getting immunity, or you're going to get a slap on the wrist so we can get the actual evildoers, you know, in the act of with your testimony. And that's what I feel he played here.
Yeah. And he may have thought he was built for this, you know, and once the, you know, explosion happened and the death of Brian Wells, and then, you know, the planning of that body may have come completely different to him. And it may have been, you know, just may not have been able to deal with it the way he thought he was going to.
I mean, this was a guy who was a loser his whole life. One of his friends described him as he never finished anything. Like, he started to become a pilot and he didn't finish that. And he, you know, so maybe this was his grand exit. Leave us all with this mystery.
One of my listeners, Allison, wrote in, she had asked, did they really have to cut Brian's head off to get the collar off?
They did. I mean, they made that decision. Did they really have to do it to get it off? I guess, because they were afraid that it was booby-trapped. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was a horrible new detail that I didn't know from regular press coverage until Trey told me about that, and that was just so tragic.
Yeah, and it was two layers. It was to keep the integrity of the device, and it was also the medical examiner in the coroner's office is in the basement of the Erie courthouse, and they were concerned they could not be told with you know, at 100% that if the device was tinkered with that it wouldn't go off.
Mm-hmm.
So even if there was a small chance that it, you know, could have gone off, they decided to, you know, err on the side of caution, which is, you know, it's just another unbelievably shocking, horrible event in this.
And the fact that the bomb had, you know, a cell phone and extra wires and all this, I guess, misdirection about it was, again, it's just one more level of manipulation.
Right. All the warnings and all of it was fake. You know, all those warnings were, the bomb was, it didn't have booby traps. The other detail that was always, that struck me that I didn't know about from regular press coverage when this story happened back in 2003 was the fact that there were two cotter pins on the bomb. Only one had been pulled. Had anybody around Brian known to pull that second cotter bomb, he would have had another hour of life, which was, you know, supposed to be for him to finish that bizarre scavenger hunt, but they had intercepted him before he was able to finish that. So, you know, another missed opportunity and just tragedy upon tragedy in this case.
All right. Was there anything else you guys wanted to say that I didn't ask you about?
It's really, we are so thankful to Netflix to provide that, to find a home for long form stories like this. I mean, the state of journalism today is, you know, there aren't as many investigative units in local newsrooms anymore. And it's just really, we're thankful to have an outlet like Netflix that will allow good journalism and doesn't force you to make it, tell it in, you know, an hour, where you get to tell the story as long as it needs to be told. And if it wasn't for, you know, Mark Duplass and his brother Jay Duplass, they're the executive producers, along with Josh Braun from Submarine Entertainment and his brother Dan. I mean, it was just this great meeting of the minds, because Mark heard about our project from our sales agent that was mutual to both of us, and he says, "How has nobody ever told this story before?" Took it to Netflix, and they opened up the door, and were able to tell a story. And I hope Netflix continues doing this, because the work is, you know, it's wonderful when you can tell a story the way it should be told, and maybe get, you know, a second chance at justice.
I would second that, saying that the Netflix creatives have been fantastic, and every filmmaker should be so lucky to have Mark Duplass as an executive producer and guiding force. He's just a great guy and so smart and creative. Has such a great touch on the zeitgeist.
Wild Country, evil genius. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah, I just watched the Wild Country. Oh my goodness, the range of emotions you feel while watching that.
Uh-huh. They're good journeys. They're good journeys.
Yeah. Well, I found it was a little, I chuckled a little bit when you said you can tell a story in more than an hour. And I just thought to myself, most journalism today is telling the story in a headline, not even in a TV show. It's like you have to fit it all in one headline. You don't even get to tell the story. So I like the long form myself, because you never get the detail that you want from a regular TV show that has commercials. You know, it might be an hour long TV show, but then you got to cut out 25 minutes of that for commercial time and whatnot. So I really appreciate, you know, any of the Netflix or whatever doing a long form, because you get the raw story from you guys that are the storytellers.
And one thing I also wanted to add is that, you know, the people in Erie have been so supportive of this project from the get-go. And, you know, this is really something that, you know, we probably, you know, give back to them and hope that this, you know, gives them some sense of closure.
I think you portrayed the town of Erie as in a very positive light. And law enforcement and even the Italian restaurant owner, everybody. It's I felt like that would be a place I would go visit sometime. It seems really down to earth and homely.
I'm from the Midwest, and we would drive to New York, and our family, we'd stop off in Erie and hang out on Presque Isle, take a little tour there. So I've always had a fondness for Erie and never thought I'd be back under these circumstances.
Where in the Midwest are you from?
I'm from Ohio, a small town.
Okay.
In Ohio, where they Gibson standard toilets.
I'm in Kansas City, Missouri, so.
Ah, good.
Yay. Got barbecue and stuff. Well, awesome. Well, I don't want to keep you guys too long. I know you have interviews lined up and no sleep, so I don't want to keep you too long. But thank you so much for talking to me. It was really cool to get to interview you guys.
Great questions. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Well, you guys have a great one, and I'll be looking forward to any new projects and shows you guys are putting out.
Maybe we'll do a good genius this time.
Perfect.
Thank you, Justin. Thanks so much.
Hey, you guys have a good one. Thank you.
Bye.
Today's episode is brought to you by Third Love. Third Love bras are tailored to both size and shape and come in exclusive half-cup sizes. Armed with the measurements of millions of women, Third Love scrapped the standard bra cup size mold and developed their own. These bras are designed to fit real women. So skip the trip to the store and use their online fit finder quiz. Answer a few simple questions in less than a minute, and it'll come up with the perfect fit in size and shape. So no more awkward fitting room experiences. Most bra brands carry 15 sizes. Third Love carries 60 from AA through G. 50% of women fall in between cup sizes, so they invented half cup sizes. Their bras have tagless labels, so no itching, straps that won't slip, ultra soft smoothing fabrics, and lightweight memory foam cups.
Third Love guarantees a perfect fit. Returns and exchanges are always free and easy. Third Love knows that there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now, they're offering our listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/GenY and find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your purchase. That's thirdlove.com/GenY for 15% off today. Thank you.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.